This is a continuation of what we have just been speaking about. So we're just continuing on to from the previous recording. I just want to read something from Tim Hegg's book and the book of Romans regarding verse 23 and verse 24 as well. Verse 23, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." Perhaps the most important question to be asked initially is how these verses are structured, particularly verse 24 fits together with verse 22 to 23. Specifically, we must ask how diakonomia, being justified, attaches to what comes before and who is the subject of that participle is. The following options seem apparent. Again, verse 22, "Even the righteousness of God through faith in Messiah Yeshua for all those who believe, for there is no distinction." And then verse 23, "For all have fallen short of the glory of God." Verse 24, "Being justified as a gift by his grace through the redemption which is in Messiah Yeshua." So number one, that those being justified are the quote all of verse 23, so that the sense is that they are all sinners, but all are being justified. Number two, that those being justified are the quote all of verse 22, i.e., quote all who believe, and that verse 23 is a parenthetical statement to explain or give explanation why there is no distinction, because all have equally sinned and are therefore sinners. And number three, that verse 24 begins a new and independent sentence. I'm inclined to go with option number one, which is, again, that the all is the sense that all are sinners, but all are being justified. With a further explanation that the, quote, "all who believe" of verse 22 is the governing idea, and therefore the "all have sinned" of verse 23 refers specifically in this case to those who have believed, proving that among them there is no distinction of race. Thus, verse 24 goes on to show yet another reason why there is no distinction, namely that all who have commonality in their sinful status and who share in the singularity of their faith also share equally the eternal gift of God's righteousness. For example, the method which God explains in order to declare sinners righteous. If this interpretation is correct, then verse 23, one of the most memorized verses of Romans, is generally misunderstood, for it is usually taught as giving substantiation for universal sinfulness of mankind, but in the context would, in this interpretation, only be speaking of the sinfulness of all who believe. Verse 23 then emphasizes that those who have believed and have therefore been given right standing before God find a commonality in being sinners and having fallen short of God's glory. The past tense, aorist, in the word "have sinned" should not be forced as teaching that those who come to faith in Messiah no longer sin. Rather, the aorist is most likely a collective being viewed, as it were, from the vantage point of the final judgment day. That the judgment day may well be in Paul's mind is hinted in that every mouth may be stopped, regarding verse 19. Thus the final judgment may reveal that all have sinned, or will reveal that all have sinned. Secondly, the commonality among all who believe is that they fall short of the glory of God. The word translated, quote, "fall short" is from the Greek hysterein, which means be behind, come too late or fail to obtain, lack, to be inferior to fail or be wanting. Paul uses the word elsewhere in 1 Corinthians 1:7, 8:8, and 12:24, and 2 Corinthians 11:5 and verse 9, and chapters 12:11 and Philippians 4:12. This verse thus teaches that not only are all men, but also all believers still lack this glory of God, in the sense that the transcendent majesty that we will receive when we see him, for we will become like him, 1 John 3:2, is not yet ours. This is not to deny that there is a radiant glory in the sense of the word that emanates from believers through the indwelling spirit. But it does emphasize that we have not yet received all that we have been promised, And to use Paul's words, we will be transformed from glory to glory when we are ushered into the world to come. This future glory may be conceived of as a status in which the full glory of God can shine upon us without any diminished effect, so that we may reflect, as it were, the glory of God in all his perfections. It is therefore our constant goal to reflect more and more the glory of God without diminishing it in the least. I'm going to read Tim Hegg again his commentary in verse 25, when it says, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith. Propitiation is the Greek word helasterion, a word found 27 times in the Septuagint, which refers to 21 of which refer to the mercy seat. In fact, the only other time that the word is found in the apostolic writings, Hebrews 9:5, it refers to the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. It is clear then that this meaning, i.e. mercy seat, must have been attached to the word in its first century usage. In fact, it is from this association with the mercy seat of the ark that the term gained its general meaning of propitiation. For the mercy seat is that place where the wrath of God is conciliated. Thus, to be propitiated to God is to be in that place where his wrath, rightly deserved by sinners, is quenched, and he rather extends a call for friendship and peace. This place of propitiation is perfectly symbolized by the mercy seat, being as it was the place where the blood was applied, interposed between the watchful eye of the cherubim and the symbols of God's kingship against which Israel rebelled, the 10 words, the jar of manna, and Aaron's rod, again, which were within the mercy seat. The word propitiation is now followed by 5 descriptive phrases, all explaining some particular aspect of it. Number 1, through faith. That is, this propitiation to God is available to the one who believes. It follows then that apart from faith, it is impossible to escape the wrath of God. For propitiation is available only by faith. This once again excludes any possibility that one could gain propitiation through physical lineage, i.e. flesh or being Jewish, or through obtaining the status of Jewish through becoming a proselyte, i.e. the works of the Torah. 2, in his blood. This phrase is the second to describe the propitiation and should not be connected to faith. Although Paul is teaching about faith in Messiah's blood instead of faith in the Messiah himself, rather the propitiation is in his blood. This is to teach us, rather, that the only means by which Yeshua could be the propitiation the Father had purposed for him to be was through the shedding of his blood, connecting the ultimate sacrifice of Yeshua to all the sacrifices prescribed in the Torah, which are nothing more or less than signposts pointing to Calvary. Yeshua is the ultimate sacrifice to which all the sacrifices point. Consider Leviticus 17:11 in the Septuagint and the parallel Greek terms. For the life of every flesh is its blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make propitiation for your souls. For it is its blood in exchange for the soul that makes propitiation. Number 3, the third descriptive phrase considers the seeming contradiction of God overlooking sin, and describes yet another aspect of the propitiation, namely that by it God answers the objection of justice, which demands that sinners be punished. He will not be the good and merciful God had he been content to pass over sins indefinitely, for this would have been to condone evil, a denial of his own nature, and a cruel betrayal of sinners. Cranfield explains, a commentator, God has in fact been able to hold his hand and pass over sins without compromising his goodness and mercy, because his intention has all along been to deal with them once and for all, decisively and finally through the cross. Paul is saying in these 2 verses that God proposed for eternity that Messiah, in order that the reality of God's righteousness, that is, in his goodness and mercy, which could be called in question by his passing over sins committed up to the time of that decisive act, might be established. Number 4, the fourth phrase describing the propitiation is, quote, to demonstrate at the present time his righteousness. This is almost identical with the previous phrase, at least in theme, with the addition of at the present time. Here Paul seems to lump together the actual event of the cross as well as the proclamation of the gospel during his time. Thus, for Paul, the propitiation that God made for sinners is attached to an historical event and is proclaimed by the preaching of that event. In one sense, then, both the historical event as well as the proclamation of it are part of God's determined plan to accomplish his salvation. And number five, the fifth phrase describing the propitiation is that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Yeshua. The emphasis in this phrase is not that God purposed to show his righteousness by propitiation in Yeshua, but that he actually is righteous. For to forgive without repayment of damages is hardly to be righteous. God could only, therefore, have predetermined the propitiation through Yeshua as a public event, for his very righteous nature required it so. He is therefore just, even the justifier of the ungodly. The word "and" in this phrase can surely be taken adverbially in the sense that it would be that God might be righteous even in justifying. So let's skip down now to verse 31. Do we then nullify the Torah through faith? May it never be. On the contrary, we establish the Torah. Why would anyone have questioned whether or not the preaching of Paul nullified the Torah? Most likely the answer to this question is simply that Paul's teachings of grace fostered in the hearts of some the notion that forgiveness on the basis of pure grace would surely lead to unrighteous living. Quote, "Let us sin that grace may abound." But Paul's obvious conclusion is that justification on the basis of faith alone, far from nullifying the Torah, establishes it. For the Torah has always had faith at its core and was given to point to the Messiah. The Torah then pointed all who would have eyes to see and ears to hear to the Messiah. Having come to faith in the Messiah is then to confirm the message of the Torah, not to nullify it. What is more, Paul's premise is that the doers of the Torah, not merely the hearers of the Torah, are justified before God. Romans 2:13. Thus the Torah, leading the sinner to Messiah, is established in that the believer walks not according to the deeds of the flesh, but through the Spirit who fulfills the requirements of the Torah within him. In this way, faith in the Messiah establishes the Torah as it recreates within the believer a heart upon which the Torah is written and therefore lived out in humble obedience. Here is a strong corrective to those who teach that the Torah is abolished or nullified. Kartogio is a word which means to nullify or render of no consequence, render ineffective. Through faith in Messiah, Paul speaks in direct opposition to just such teaching. So Paul's saying that faith in Messiah in no way negates the Torah, because the Torah has now been written upon our heart, and the Ruach is going to lead us into the way of the Torah if we are obedient and listen to what he is speaking in our heart, because he will always lead us into obedience to the Torah. In David Stern's commentary, the Complete New Testament, or Complete Jewish Bible, he comments on verse 31, "Does it follow that we abolish Torah by this trusting? Shaul follows the rabbinic method found throughout the Talmud of anticipating a hypothetical questioner, and not so hypothetical if one reads the literature of Jewish attitudes towards Christianity. Here is his argument. You might think that the assertion, quote, works of the law are of no avail for salvation is tantamount to overthrowing the Torah itself. If you were used to thinking of the Torah as a rule book capable of being followed mechanically without trusting in God. For this very reason, Shaul, in order to keep the attention of those who would otherwise reject anything more he has to say, addresses this issue head on, answering in the negative as strongly as possible, heaven forbid. On the contrary, we confirm Torah or uphold it, establish it, or place it on a firm foundation. Why does trusting, which is the exact opposite of mechanical rule keeping, confirm Torah? Because trusting God and not mechanical rule keeping is the very basis, foundation, and essence of Torah. It is what the Torah is about. In saying so, Shaul does not exhaust the subject, far from it. It is his literary style, however, to introduce the topic briefly, allowing the reader to be filled with questions about it, and then later return to it. That is what he does here. He returns to the matter of how faith and Torah fit together, and we'll see that later on in chapters 7 and verses 9 to 11. So again, let's look at verse 27. Where is boasting then? Many of the Jews of Paul's day, instead of being a light to the Gentiles, which we were called to be, had taken the Torah and used it to create a legalistic righteousness unto themselves, as Yeshua also accused them of. Paul raises the issue of Torah-based faith versus self-righteous legalism, again in verses 9:30 and 10:4 and 11:6. The view of some of his fellow Jews of being better than the Gentiles simply because they had the Torah was a form of covetousness of the Torah and was a sin. Although the Jews had the advantage of the Torah, why? Because God revealed himself to them and they had knowledge of righteousness and how they were to live, where the Gentiles did not. The fact is that according to the Shema, there is one God for both Jew and Gentile. Verse 28, a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. Without an understanding of Paul's Hebrew mindset, he can almost sound schizophrenic. After all, he says a man is not saved by the law, but in the previous chapter he stated in Romans 2:13, for not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. As always, context is critical. Verses 3:28 sums up the substance of the previous verses. God's Torah, properly understood and followed, that is not to be used to seek justification as a reward for works, summon men to, quote, faith. However, this faith includes turning from sin, as defined by God's Torah, to a life of grateful obedience to God by learning and submitting to his Torah. Paul is dealing with both types of error common to man. If someone tries to do the works of Torah outside of faith and, quote, earn salvation, that person will fail. Conversely, if anyone claims to have faith but willfully ignores God's Torah, this also fails. Scripture calls such a person a liar, 1 John 2, 3-5. Again, behind the more obvious meaning of the verse, all are saved by faith, is the additional understanding and teaching of Paul that opposed the exclusivity that denied Gentiles equal access to God without first converting to Judaism since Yeshua's death. This was a decision of Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, again based on the Shema, which Paul and the other disciples took out to the existing Messianic communities and to their new evangelistic campaigns. The goal of the Torah is faith in Israel's Messiah as the Savior of the entire world. God is one God for all people through faith, which upholds the Torah. Verse 29, is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also of the Gentiles? Here again, Paul uses the Shema in his teaching to show God is the God of the Gentiles also, as seen in this and the next verse. Monotheism and Torah are inseparable to Paul. In verse 31, do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid, yea, we establish the law. Despite Paul's careful arguments in explaining the essence of the Torah, there is still the possibility that some might come to the false conclusion that Torah was not for the believer in Yeshua. Paul therefore makes it clear that trusting God is what the Torah is all about. Recognizing you are a sinner, which is done through knowing what the Torah calls sin, turning to God and following his Torah as the guideline for your life is the path for both Jews and Gentiles. Unfortunately, the mystery of iniquity, violation of Torah that Paul warned was creeping into the Messianic community in his day, and today has become the norm for most people, claiming to follow Messiah, who say they are now subjected to the law of God. Again, this is why it's important to understand how to interpret scriptures, that God does not contradict himself, that the Torah is for the redeemed, but it's not a means of salvation. It's to show us to how to live a holy life that God requires of those that are his people. We're going to continue on next week. We're going to go to chapter 4, again, continuing in our study on the book of Romans from a Hebraic context. Hopefully this will be a blessing to you, and Shalom and Yeshua. Father, I thank you that, again, for that you give us, continue to give us understanding and discernment and how to correctly, Father, study your word, not taking it out of context, not trying to make it say what we want it to say, Father, but clearly seeing your grace and mercy, Father, from the beginning of Genesis to the end of Revelation, Father, and that you have given us a path to walk, and that path is faith in you and faith in Messiah Yeshua, that causes us to be written epistles before men. Father, I thank you that we are obedient to your word and we walk by faith. And Father, because we walk by faith, the works follow as well. And we just thank you for this time in your word. In Yeshua's name, amen.